This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch, the Friday edition. Eben Fowler sitting in today, guest hosting for my friend Tony Perkins. We are glad to have you along. As usual, great topics this afternoon on the broadcast. First up on today's show, as we near President Trump's first 100 days in office, I wonder, what's the big deal about 100 days? And, of course, President Trump has been asking that question, too. Everybody expects the new president, to have everything done in the first 100 days, at any rate. But tax reform, we're hearing about that again. We might be closer to the old repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And we're going to find out what's going on. Representative Warren Davidson will be here in just a couple of minutes. He is a Republican from Ohio, and he's a member of the Freedom Caucus. So I'm kind of interested to hear what's going on inside there, since they were supposedly, according to the news reports, some of the folks who were kind of pushing back on the first go-round on that repeal and replace. A second topic today, next Monday is the Holocaust Day of Remembrance, when we honor some 6 million Jews murdered during World War II. Susan Hagee of a neat organization called Abundant Hope International will join us to talk about the importance of remembering and also about what her organization does. And then, you guessed it, Planned Parenthood is rearing its really ugly head again. We're talking about the possibility of 4 new abortion clinics in Missouri. You heard that right. A judge's ruling just might allow that to happen. We're going to dig into that with Susan Klein. She's with Missouri Right to Life. She'll be here with that discouraging news, and hopefully we can find out some things that we might be able to do to help intervene there as that goes on. And, of course, we'll take your calls in the last segment of the program. Susan Klein is going to stay with us, and we'll be able to talk with her and talk about that particular issue with the Planned Parenthood case. Well, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says the Trump administration is close to unveiling what they call major tax reform. It also appears lawmakers might be close to a deal to repeal and replace Obamacare. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, joining us now is Congressman Warren Davidson. He represents the 8th District of Ohio. He serves on the Financial Services Committee, and as I mentioned just a few minutes ago, he's a member of the House Freedom Caucus. I know you're back in the district, Congressman, meeting with constituents. There's certainly a lot of talk about that, and we will get to that. But let's first talk about tax reform. President Trump is apparently going to sign an order reviewing 2016 tax rules. So tell us all about what you know about that. Thanks for joining the program, by the way.
Well, tax reform is one of the most iconic things about what changed since the election. So when I first got to Congress in June of last year in a special election, Chairman Kevin Brady, he's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, had just launched the blueprint for Republican tax reform, and it's better.gop explains the overall playbook. Tax is one of them. And everyone's like, oh, Chairman, great plan. And then on November 14th, that was our first day back in session after the election. And it was amazing to watch all the people line up and say, Chairman, about that tax plan, I have a concern about XYZ. Because now it was real. It was something that was going to be signed into law. So I'm anxious to see where we go going forward. The blueprint is pretty bold, and I think it lays out a good framework for us to move forward in.
Give us a few of the high points. Let's stick with the tax plan right now. What are some of the things that you're seeing that really might happen?
Yeah, so corporate rates are really the first and most likely thing to be addressed, because a lot of the future plans depend on repatriating dollars that are offshore right now, $2.5 trillion roughly of corporate cash that's offshore, because our corporate tax code is incredibly broken compared to the rest of the world. And so rates will be lower. There will be an incentive to repatriate dollars. But some of the other big reforms that I hope we can still get to, one of them is 100% expensing. So when that would put you closer to a consumption basis. So if you spent money for large pieces of capital equipment, there's various deductions and incentives and everything else, this reform would get away with line item deductions and special interest deductions, special credits for this, that, or the other thing, and just say, if you spent the money this year, you can expense it on your taxes, and then you have a carry forward loss if you didn't use it all up this year on the expense side. That would be good. And then part of the pay for is the real controversial part of that is border adjusted tax. And that's the most controversial piece. And so if the border adjustable tax goes away, that's the real question. What else has to go away? And because a fair amount of the additional revenue comes in off that tax.
A couple of things. First of all, let's go back to the $2.5 trillion, the estimated amount of money that has just sort of flown out of the country, and as they say, it's been offshored. Explain how and why that's happened, and kind of over what period of time that it's taken for that much money to accrue outside the United States.
Yeah, so the U.S. has somewhat unique among major countries, major economies, tax code, and we tax global profits. So that incentivizes companies like Apple, for example, to recognize revenue outside of the United States for their global business. They sell iPhones all over the world, as you would imagine. And if they keep that as Apple USA, then those dollars would be taxed at a higher rate in the United States because we have the world's largest, highest tax rate.
Right.
And so they license some of their intellectual property. They, you know, recognize revenue in Ireland, for example, where they only have a 12.5% tax rate versus the U.S.'s 35% tax rate. And so because of that, they hold a fair bit of cash, $180 to $200 billion in their case offshore. And that's not because Tim Cook's being accused of being some right-wing ideologue. As far as I know, he never has been. It's because he's rational. That's the way our tax code is. And it incentivizes that type of corporate structure, which is inefficient inherently, but it's more than paid for by the differential in tax treatment.
Okay, so if I'm Tim Cook, and I'm not, by the way, but let's say take any CEO of any major corporation who's been doing those things, essentially who's been incentivized to work around the system to keep those dollars outside of the United States. I'm going to say, okay, members of Congress, you're saying that you're going to do this, you're going to change this stuff in the structure, but I'm afraid, I don't believe it's going to stay that way, because I'm afraid the next administration, you know, whether it's 4 or 8 years from now, that they're going to change the rules again. How would you answer that? And is that really a concern?
Yeah, I think it's a real concern, but, 10 years is a long horizon. The real question is, can you do it faster? And that's where some of the Bush-era tax cuts were challenging, because they had an expiration date, because CBO, Congressional Budget Office, scores our budgets, and they score tax proposals. And they say, well, it's deficit neutral, it's revenue neutral, it's this, that, or the other thing. And in order to do more ambitious things, one temptation is to say, well, we'll just have them be true for 10 years, and then they'll come back in, and so it'll meet the score. But we need to not do that, I think. We need to do something that says, A, it'll be retroactive, so people go ahead and continue to invest this year, and they don't manage their year around that. That's a way to wind up with an unintended consequence of a recession this year, because people are holding their cash instead of investing it for looking for better treatment in the future. And the other part is, when you have some certainty about the framework going forward, it is hard to get this kind of thing done, and that's highlighted with what changed post-election. No one really believed that the blueprint would be the law of the land if Hillary Clinton had won the election, but now that President Trump had won it, people said, wait, this is what's going to be law unless we start speaking up now.
Well, 35%, and as I think as most people know who've been doing any reading or listening to any stories about our economy, this 35% is ridiculous. And as you said, it's among the highest corporate tax rate in the world. How did we ever get to that point, and why didn't people in government figure out that that was quite detrimental to the growth of business?
Yeah, I don't understand the why. That's one of my big questions on policy. I understand the demand for bad policy. I just can't understand why it's so readily supplied. But in terms of the treatment in corporate, it's corporations inherently don't vote, and so voters say, well, just get it from the corporations. But the reality is the corporate tax rate's embedded in all the cost of goods sold in the country, in the regular economy. So realistically, corporations don't truly pay the tax. That's embedded in the price of whatever we buy as consumers.
Right, we're paying it.
But then on the back end, what other people have lobbied for, and this has caused issues now. I mean, people come in and lobby and make their case. And, well, what about this special credit? And what about this exemption here? And what about that incentive there? The tax code's got so many little things like that that the effective tax rate for most bigger corporations is in the 20s, you know, but it's still higher than the effective tax rate in most of the rest of the world.
Well, then let's just take a minute, because I want to get to healthcare repeal and replace before we run out of time. But just give me for a minute or so here, what kinds of things might change in terms of, you know, you and I and our personal income tax and the thing that we dread every April 15th, or in this case, April 18th each year? How might it affect individuals?
Yeah, so that plan is also pretty ambitious. The goal is, about a 5x8 postcard size return, which is similar to the 1040 EZ form that a lot of people file. But the goal is to massively expand the population that can file that simple form. And it's also a simplification of rates, effectively a lower rate for everyone or nearly everyone. And in order to do that, it eliminates a lot of special exemptions and deductions there. People that have lots of concerns about the mortgage interest, it keeps that. People that have concerns about charitable contribution, it keeps that. But most
Good.
Other incentives and deductions go away, and it just massively simplifies the tax code.
That's great. And what do you think the chances are that this thing is going to get through and get passed?
Boy, I don't know. In a lot of things in the House, I will say that the real challenge will be what happens in the Senate. And, you know, as you alluded to, you know, first 100 days you were speaking earlier, it's been a slow start over in the Senate in particular. And that's the delay of game strategy that Schumer and the Senate Democrats have run there. So effectively, most cabinet, Secretary Mnuchin doesn't have a full staff. He's not playing with a full team yet. And so their strategy there has been to run out the clock. And I hope that everyone will get more cooperative and focus on helping us govern the country.
Yeah, Mnuchin's not playing with a full staff, and I'm afraid Mr. Schumer is not playing with a full deck the way he obstructs and keeps things. It's just an awful lot of rhetoric that's not very helpful to the country here. Well, let's move to repeal and replace. Got just about a little over a minute here, Representative Davidson. You know, the first go-round, I think most of us heard the Freedom Caucus was one of the entities that was pushing back, and I think probably for good reason, because the first go-round was not so great. So give us a quick synopsis of where we are now and what you're seeing with the attempt. Oh, we're just about out of time, so make it 30 seconds if you would.
Well, the cliff notes is the progress never really stopped. There was a bit of a pause. There was an embarrassing pause. We wanted to hit the deadline of the anniversary, but the progress and dialogue between across the conference just wasn't there. In the background, some really good guys have continued to work together to get this done. And I think we're on the verge of having an agreement that's going to be a much better bill. And frankly, we're going to have a better way to work together going forward.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much for spending your time. Warren Davidson out of Ohio, we appreciate your time and your expertise today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, between 1933 and 1945, nearly 6 million Jews were killed at the hand of Adolf Hitler in what was known as the Holocaust. Monday is the Holocaust Day of Remembrance. We're going to be talking about that in our next segment.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms, in association with American Family Studios, introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrady's. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Pre-order your copy today at afastore.net.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. I don't know about you, but I think I do. Let me explain. I don't want my children or any of my friends or loved ones watching, viewing, peering, sneaking peeks at pornography, and I don't think you do either. Pornography does untold damage as Satan uses it to worm his way into the hearts, minds, and lust patterns of vulnerable human beings like you and me. Can you fathom this? According to statistics provided by Tim Challis at age 11, the average child has already been exposed to explicit pornographic content through the internet. Pornography desensitizes, leading quickly to addiction. Challis writes, quoting, "Parents are nothing short of negligent if they take no steps to protect their children from being exposed to pornography," unquote. May this not be true for you or me. Place no wicked thing before your eyes. Psalm 101, 3a. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
8 Days of Hope 13 is headed to Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. Hi, I'm Steve Tiber with 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope is a faith-based ministry. We've gone all over the country to help families rebuild after natural disasters. We've helped almost 1,800 families rebuild their homes, sometimes from the ground up. Lafayette, Louisiana, and the whole state of Louisiana got hit by epic flooding last year in August. Almost 25 inches of rain fell, and almost $20 billion of damage was done. Literally 140,000 homes flooded. Think about that, 140,000 families waiting for somebody to be a glimpse of Jesus. You can be a skilled professional, or you can be somebody like me who's less skilled but wants to give back. Go to 8daysofhope.com. We provide the food and lodging, and you can learn a lot more about the ministry. And we can't wait to see you in Lafayette, Louisiana, June 4th to June 11th. For more information, go to 8daysofhope.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network here on a Friday afternoon. Glad you are listening. Well, Monday is Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Day of Remembrance. It is held a week after the end of the Passover holiday, and it's a day to remember those who lost their lives during the Holocaust. And it's something that we should be doing from this day forward. It's something that we should never, ever forget. With us now is Susan Hagee. She's the founder and president of Abundant Hope International. Susan, thanks for being on the broadcast with us today.
Very glad to have you.
Well, first of all, tell us about your organization. What is Abundant Hope International all about?
We are all about relationships for the Holocaust survivors because they lost their families in the war. They now, many of them are completely alone or do not have much family, and we establish a relationship in order to break that loneliness cycle.
Approximately how many Holocaust survivors are still with us?
Worldwide, it's less than 1 million. In Israel alone, there are 189,000 just from the camps and the ghettos, plus you have more that are from the evacuees and the refugee status.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing that there are still that many. And of course, many of those survivors were just little ones, were they not, back during that time?
Many of them, yes. But we still have a lot of them that were teenagers and young adults because they're living into their hundreds, amazingly. But now they're dying about every 30 minutes.
Yeah, wow. Well, to have made it through something as horrific as, you know, living through being in one of those concentration camps or who knows what other kinds of horrible conditions they were in, you've got to be a survivor. You'd have to think that. Well, Abundant Hope International, how did it get started? And it is essentially, it's a Christian-based organization, is it not?
We are all believers. But we do not evangelize. What we do is do what Yeshua did. He went to the villages and he healed the sick. He prayed for them and he loved them. And that's what we do. We bring the compassion of Yeshua with us.
Well, I'd like to.
He goes in with us and then he stays.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to read. From your website, there's a page. It's the About page from Abundant Hope International. And it talks about your logo. Can I talk about that for just a minute?
Certainly, yes.
It's a neat story, and it's what it is, and I'll try to explain it to our listeners. It's a tree, and there are a couple of different sort of paths going through it, blue and brown. And the blue represents Gentile believers. Water is life to Gentile believers, in particular living or moving water. And then jumping down, it says, our survivors, when we first meet them, are like the brown leaves on the tree. And that's the representation on your logo. Old, seemingly shriveled and dry, nearing the end of their life. But when you combine the living water from the Gentile believers with the tree of life from the Jewish religion and view leaves as the survivors who came out of the death camps to help build the state of Israel, the water feeding the tree brings life to the leaves, the survivors. The Holocaust survivors we met a few years ago now show signs of new life, new growth. I think that is so neat. So tell us about some of the new life and new growth that you're experiencing as you spend time, and you know hundreds of these Holocaust survivors, but tell us, maybe give us one or two short stories.
Yes, there was one in particular, Boris. He was 17 when his parents and he were taken in a group to a forest to be killed, and all of the people were told to dig a hole, which they did. But he was right at the edge of the forest, and his parents pushed him into the bushes, and no one saw it happen. But he watched as they were all pushed into the hole, not killed, but just covered up. And for 3 days, he hid there while watching the ground move as people tried to get out, but the soldiers were guarding them. And he never got over that. You could see it in his face every time he even thought about it. He was like an elderly child. He always wanted to play with some toys in order to entertain himself. He never changed. We had another a woman, Branislava, who just really impressed me with the fact that she had her two boys, and they were marched out from their village with 2,000 Jews in the Ukraine, and they were the only three to survive. And it's because she had reached a point towards the end. The rest of them were being killed, and she actually fell to her knees and asked the Lord to save her children. And a Nazi officer suddenly appeared in front of her. He was not there, and then he was. He reached out, and he said, I've come to save your children, and he took the three of them away. And they were the only three to survive that massacre.
Wow. Well, so
we hear critical things.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Why is it important for the younger generation to be aware of the Holocaust? Because, you know, that the history is fading, of course, but why is it so important that this story be carried on, that people understand what happened and what can happen?
The anti-Semitism today, the anger that is building against the Jewish people it's building exactly like it did before World War II. And it was accepted by other people during that time. If we do not know about it, then it will be repeated. And the survivors, every time we visit them, they say, please tell the others, especially the youth, please tell them. Don't forget us who are still living and remember those who have died. Tell them our stories. And so that's what I do. I go anywhere, someone will open it up for me, and I will simply tell their stories.
Well, now, if we have listeners who maybe are members of churches or organizations and they want to have some of these stories told, how can they connect with your ministry?
They can go on our website on ahi-il.org. And all you have to do is contact us through the on the donation page or anywhere there. You can just write to us, and we'll make arrangements. I will come or someone else will come, and we will tell these stories. We believe that anyone who hears these stories becomes the new survivor because the original ones are dying, and somebody has to keep this alive. We are responsible to keep that history alive.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for the ministry that you do to the survivors and for the survivors. Again, that web address is ahi-il.org, ahi-il.org. Well, coming up next, a judge's ruling just may very well allow Planned Parenthood to reopen dangerous Missouri abortion clinics putting women at risk, and, of course, babies. Susan Klein with Missouri Right to Life will join us in the next segment with the unfortunate details about the case, and then we'll take your calls in our last segment. Stay with us.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, a lot of housing numbers have been coming out all week long, and one of the things that we are seeing is the fact that we have a very limited supply of homes. A very limited supply. As a matter of fact, new homes and existing homes counted, we have the lowest supply of homes for sale on record. Lowest supply on record. Now, there's been a lot lately that the left financial news has been talking about, trying to criticize the Trump economy. This after a whopping 100 days in office. And one of the things they're saying is the millennial generation that a year ago were all living at home are a year later still living at home. Well, look. We've got a undersupply of homes. They've been living at home to try to save money to buy a home. Because of all the regulatory changes, they have to have 20% down. And the problem is the goalpost continues to move. And now the 20% that they think they're getting close to, now they have to save a little bit longer because the price of the homes continue to go up. And thankfully, mortgage rates have stayed relatively low. Not to mention that jobs are becoming more and more abundant. We have the best labor market we've had in 17 years. But until that tightening in the labor force really begins to sink in, we're not going to see wages increase until at least the latter part of the year at a minimum. One could say that a lot of that has to do with what's happening in the housing industry.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network here in Kansas City on this Friday afternoon, early evening almost, depending upon where you're listening. And we're glad you're listening today. Thanks so much for that. U.S. District Judge by the name of Howard F. Sachs blocked Missouri regulations Wednesday that require abortion facilities to meet basic health and safety standards. That ruling might mean that four abortion facilities will likely open, in some cases, in a couple of cases, reopen in the state soon. With us now to discuss this disturbing turn of events is Susan Klein. She's the executive director of Missouri Right to Life. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I am doing well. You know, here we go. Planned Parenthood, once again, they're at it again. And they, for some reason, they seem to think that they can have these medical clinics open, these abortion clinics, where all kinds of things can happen to a woman if the abortion doesn't go the right way. I mean, it never goes the right way because there's always a life lost. But, you know, if the so-called doctor, I don't call them doctors because they're not really doctors. They don't deserve that title. But those who perform abortions, if one of them messes up, which they do, and that clinic does not have the kind of standards that really any other ambulatory surgical clinic should have, then that woman is put at risk. Tell us about the case that just turned and went the wrong way on Wednesday, and let's get into this topic a little bit.
Well, thank you, Evan, for having me, and you're absolutely right. What happened Wednesday is just was an egregious decision by Judge Sachs. And when he blocked two Missouri pro-life laws, these laws have been in effect since 2005. And I want to talk about the specifics of these two laws that he blocked because they are standards of medical.
Sounds like we lost Susan there for just a second. Okay. So while we try to get Susan back, let's talk about this just a little bit more. She was about to tell us about the two laws that were overturned by this judge. You know, this morning I was listening to a broadcast, and what it was a conversation that included either the president or the executive director, I don't remember what her title is, of a Planned Parenthood entity here in the Midwest, and they were talking about, in, at least in part, this situation. And it's just amazing. They're so good at spinning things. And you know, they talk about women's health. And in fact, we've talked about this before. You've got Planned Parenthood clinics that fly these banners. It's kind of a public relations campaign that they had going where they said, health care happens here. Well, you know, if you look at, and I challenge you, go to a Planned Parenthood website, kind of poke around in whatever area you're listening in, and look up the local Planned Parenthood, and then go and try to find the list of health care services they provide. It's a pretty short list. I did this for the kind of the Midwest area Planned Parenthood clinics. The list is really short, and it has mainly to do with reproductive stuff, which, you know, you can imagine. And there's just not very many. When they say health care happens here, that's really not the truth at all. And well, Susan's back online. Susan, I was just talking with our listeners about the banners that Planned Parenthood flies that say health care happens here, and how that's kind of what would you say is misleading advertising, if you will?
Absolutely, it's misleading, because if you look at these two laws that Judge Sack blocked. I mean, basically, I don't understand how a healthcare facility can, you know, fight from having a doctor have hospital privileges within 30 miles of where that physician is performing those abortions. And that's one of the laws that Judge Sachs blocked. So prior to this law going into effect in 2005, we had physicians who were coming in performing abortions and doing botched abortions on women. And they didn't have hospital privileges even in the United States. Their hospital privileges were outside of the United States, like in Peru. So, you know, you can't have good medical care if you don't have a physician that has the ability to go to the hospital if there's an emergency situation. And then the other thing that Judge Sachs blocked was that requirement that every abortion facility be classified as an ambulatory surgical center and have the same medical requirements to have, you know, good quality medical care as any ambulatory surgical center. Now, obviously, we don't agree that you know, getting an abortion is quality medical care, but just having, making sure that there aren't, dirty tables and rusty equipment and expired drugs and untrained medical personnel. And that's part of what ambulatory surgical center regulations make sure is not happening. There is absolutely not good quality healthcare going on in Planned Parenthood at all.
Yeah, and I was what I was talking about while you had dropped off the line was a program that I was listening to today, that, and you may have heard this same program, that in part one of the guests was the executive director, president, whatever, of Planned Parenthood Great Plains, which is kind of the entity that that curses this part of the country with their presence. And we'll get back to talking about that a little bit more, and a little bit more about the where this decision might go. And we also are going to talk about some of the things that have happened in the one abortion clinic that still is open in Missouri and St. Louis. You won't want to miss this. So what we're going to do is come back. We're going to talk to Susan some more about the decision that took place on Wednesday. And we're going to take your calls. Here's the number, 866-372-7234. Write that down. It's 866-372-7234. We'd like you to join the conversation. We're going to be talking about this particular topic, and we'd love to have you be part of the program today. You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler sitting in today for Tony Perkins. Thanks for listening. We'll be back after this break.
We at the American Family Association believe men should not be allowed to use women's restrooms or dressing rooms. Yet the policy of Target allows just that. Do you agree that this policy poses danger to our women and children? Then sign the Boycott Target Pledge. When you do, you're saying, until Target makes the safety of women and children a priority, I'll shop elsewhere. The good news is the boycott is making a big difference. A Target financial report indicates a dramatic drop in their sales and earnings. And a Wall Street Journal article clearly shows that Target CEO Brian Cornell regrets his company's policy announcement welcoming men to use women's restrooms and dressing rooms. We're convinced that together we can stop this insanity before more women and children become victims. Sign the pledge today and tell others about the boycott. Go to afa.net/target. That's afa.net/target.
Could we be the people that God could use to change the course of this generation?
Join American Family Radio Monday night at Fusion, a Heart Cry for Revival conference, a time of worship, prayer, and a message from Michael Catt, senior pastor at Sherwood Baptist Church in Albany, Georgia.
It may be that in this room that God finds one person that says, God, I want to be an instrument of revival, and God says, I'm looking for you.
Monday night at 6 Central on American Family Radio.
Heavenly Father.
The 66th annual observance of the National Day of Prayer is Thursday, May 4th. It's a day when people of faith all across America will gather for one important purpose, to pray.
Hear our cry, O God, and pour out.
The American Family Association encourages you to meet at your city hall from 1220 to 1240 local time to plead with God for a spiritual awakening in our country.
We pray with expectant faith in Jesus' dear name. Amen.
The All-American girl is not supposed to get pregnant in college. Hi, Kim Catola for Cradle My Heart Today. And Gwen Smith was not only frightened of losing her athletic scholarship, but her reputation as a good Christian girl seemed to be on the line as well. So Gwen decided to go to her appointment for that abortion anonymously. She used an alias. And she walked away determined to bury that mistake along with her unborn child. Like so many others, Gwen learned that we may choose abortion, but we cannot choose our consequences. Her guilt and grief persisted until Gwen sought help through an abortion recovery Bible study offered by a pregnancy help center. Today, she helps women see how God can turn us from broken into beautiful, bringing good out of our worst mistakes and sin. Find out more of Gwen's story and resources to find healing after abortion at cradlemyheart.org. Saving lives and healing hearts after abortion, one story at a time. CradleMyHeart.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Washington Watch. Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon, and glad to have you all along. Here's the phone number. We're going to be jumping into some phone calls here in a little while. 866-372-7234. 866-372-7234. Susan Klein, Executive Director of Missouri Right to Life, is with us. Susan, let's pick up on this conversation again. What we're talking about, for those listeners who have just joined us, is the federal judge overturning a couple of what I would say are quite reasonable regulations or laws that govern abortion clinics in the state of Missouri. Again, quickly get us up to speed on what the requirements would have been or were until the judge overthrew this stuff. And then we'll talk about where we go from here.
Okay. We have touched base on, you know, the two requirements that the judge overturned. And basically they are requiring that a physician have hospital privileges. Any physician performing abortions have hospital privileges within 30 miles of an abortion facility. And also that these abortion facilities meet the same medical standards as any ambulatory surgical center. Because when you go in for an abortion, there are absolutely possibilities, great possibilities of complications that arise. So we're just trying to make sure, you know, obviously in working under the Roe versus Wade, which we are doing right now, which, you know, we're trying to address, but right now we're working under that and having to address the issues of what's going on inside these abortion clinics.
And the Planned Parenthood propagandists, when they're asked about these regulations, they usually start crowing about how, you know, it's going to prohibit women from making their choices. And other than what they're talking about is, of course, their high profit abortions, because that's why they do them, because there's lots of money. In fact, the St. Louis abortion facility, which I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about, they charge a woman between $545 and $1,470, or almost $1,500 for an abortion. There's one doctor there, or the doctor, I guess, again, sorry, I said doctor, the person, the individual who performs these abortions, reported doing about 31 a day, which means that clinic is bringing in a whopping $45 big ones today, $45,000. So that pretty well answers the question of why Planned Parenthood is in the biz. Of course, they, you know, I think they have some true believers there who don't have their heads screwed on quite straight, who think that abortion is a good thing. But tell us about some of the things that have happened at the St. Louis Abortion Clinic, which underlines and circles why we need these kind of regulations at abortion clinics.
Well, you're exactly right as far as the profit that they make. I mean, if you're looking at a physician being able, and I use the word lightly too, being able to move women through these abortion facilities as quickly as they can, they're going to make horrible mistakes on women's bodies. And we've seen that happen multiple times in the St. Louis Planned Parenthood. There have been over 69 emergency ambulance calls just in the last several years, to this year, since the beginning of the year. But, you know, as we've done, the state has done inspections of the facility of Planned Parenthood in St. Louis, they have found, like I said before, rusty tables, rusty equipment, dirty, dusty tables, expired drugs, untrained medical personnel that don't know what they're doing in giving these drugs to women. So, you know, this oversight that came from these two laws was imperative to keep women's health, at least have some kind of, grounding in what they knew they were going to be getting whenever they walked in there. And, you know, women are not getting good quality health care there. Planned Parenthood says that they offer all these extra services like mammograms and, you know, cancer screening and all of that. And, you know, what we've done through the state budget, through our legislature, is make sure that women can get good quality health care through these federally qualified health clinics, and they get better and a broader range of health care with good ambulatory surgical center regulations on them, and physicians that have hospital privileges. So these are just common sense things, and these abortion advocates, you know, when they cry foul against these restrictions, I don't know how they can say that, you know, oh, we don't want the physician to have hospital privileges. Well, that's because they're moving women through there so quickly that they don't want to have and go back if there's some kind of medical emergency. Flown out of town.
Yeah, and I'm going to take a wild guess, too, here, and that is that some of their physicians, if they asked for hospital privileges, any decent hospital would not give them to them because of the nature of the work that they do. I don't know if that's true. I'm just guessing here. Well,
is correct, actually, because whenever this law was passed, you know, Springfield is a good example of that, and the person doing the abortions down there was not able to get hospital privileges in Springfield. So that abortion facility did close after this law was passed in 2005.
Ah, so my surmisal was maybe correct. Well, let me throw out the phone number again here, Susan. 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. We'd love to have you join the program. Well, let's talk about where we go forward here from this point. Attorney General Hawley, who we tried to get on the broadcast today, but unfortunately, and he wanted to be on the broadcast, but he had previously scheduled travel at this particular time. My understanding is that not only is he going to appeal it, but the governor of the state of Missouri is going to appeal it. What do you think is going to happen then? And then if we have time, I also want to ask you about what kind of a precedent this might set, not just in Missouri, but other states as well. So first of all, what are the legal wranglings that might be going on from here forward?
Well, when Judge Sachs made his ruling, he stated that his ruling was based off the U.S. Supreme Court of these two laws, that when the U.S. Supreme Court knocked down two laws in Texas that were similar to these. Now, they are similar, but they're not exactly the same. And the other thing that's different in this situation is that when these two laws were passed in Missouri in 2005, the 30-mile radius was not challenged, but the ambulatory surgical centers were. That part of the law was. However, there was an agreement made by then Attorney General Coster, Governor Matt Blunt, the director of the Department of Health, and Planned Parenthood, in that they would abide by certain parts of the ambulatory surgical center regs. And they signed an agreement under that clause that that they were okay with the law if it excluded certain things but included everything that we currently have in law. So our situation is different in Missouri than it was in Texas. So because Planned Parenthood has agreed to abide by these laws, and it's in writing. So I think when we come to the point where Attorney General Hawley is looking at the situation in Missouri versus the situation in Texas, I think he's going to have grounds to basically truly argue from the perspective of protecting the women in Missouri, that the state has a vested interest in that. So I believe, you know, obviously, the elections, pro-lifers went to the polls and worked hard to get a pro-life attorney general and a pro-life governor in the state of Missouri. And because of the wins that we've had in Missouri as well as in Washington, I think you are seeing Planned Parenthood coming at us and at our officials with venom to try to continue to make the money that they're making off of women that are being deceived in these clinics.
Absolutely. And that doesn't even, we haven't even talked about the sale of fetal body parts or the fraud that apparently has been committed by various Planned Parenthoods across the country, Medicare, Medicaid fraud, and that sort of thing. They have lots of different ways of getting money, including the $500 million of taxpayer money that sounds like it might just be going away. We can certainly hope that that's the case with the defunding movement. Well, one other thing here about the decision, just want to step back a little bit, Susan. Judge Sachs apparently cited a U.S. Supreme Court decision that struck down a similar Texas law in 2016. Maybe that's what you were talking about. Can you talk about that a little bit more and how that applied to this case and the decision?
Well, Judge Sachs used that as his reasoning to go ahead and rule the way he did in blocking our two laws. However, I believe that Attorney General Hawley is going to use the agreement that was our former Attorney General and our former governor came to in 2010 is when that agreement was signed. So, you know, our law, when it was passed in 2005, has been in effect, over these last 12 years and has not harmed women. And so whenever he used the Texas law, I mean, it's similar, but it's not exactly the same. And like I said, the situation is not the same because there were other agreements that are withstanding since that law was passed back in 2000. These laws were passed back in 2005.
So it's only
kind of a complicated explanation.
Yeah.
But Attorney General Hawley, I believe, is going to represent us well, and he knows the law well. He has won cases before, and I believe Governor Greitens is going to represent us well too.
Well, you know, the folks at Planned Parenthood are already, the decision, the paper it was printed on is still warm off the printer, and they're already talking about how they're going to be supplying abortion drugs to a clinic in Springfield and Columbia and, you know, who knows where else. Is there a possibility that there could be a stay on this decision so that the regulations maybe could stand up at least until an appeal?
I think it's possible. It depends on how fast they can get that, and I know Attorney General Hawley is going to use every means possible through the legal process to try to make that happen. These clinics still have to go through the licensing process, and whenever they reopen, and whether they reopen or whether they're newly opened, you know, there's still a process for them to go to. They can't just like start doing abortions immediately. The process is, in the legal process, we're going to do everything possible to stop these other clinics from opening, as well as we're going to do everything legally possible over an appeal and overrule what the judge has said.
Well, that's good, because there are literally the lives of little ones at stake. And if these abortion mills start opening up in different parts of the state, they're going to be lives that are lost. And that's the really sad part about this. Well, you know,
and there are lives being lost every 24 seconds. A baby is being killed through abortion every 24 seconds. So, you know, time is of the essence. We must work hard now.
And let me ask you this. Are there some things that listeners can do I know, obviously, you know, judges are supposed to be independent, so you can't call them like you can call your representatives and your senators and legislators. But are there things that listeners can do that might have an impact on this kind of a situation? Does it make sense for them to contact their state senator or state representative?
It absolutely does. The Senate, the legislature is in the last 3 weeks of the legislative session. They can do something with a bill that we have before them now, before the Senate, that deals with abortion clinic inspections. Right now, our law in Missouri says that abortion clinic inspections are as deemed necessary. I think if we are unable to get these laws back into effect as quickly as possible, then it's going to be more imperative than ever to be able to go into these abortion clinics and do these inspections where, you know, all these infractions have been found in the past. We're going to need them done more often than what they're being done now. So they can call their state senator and let them know that we need clinic inspections in the law now based on what this judge has ruled. And I would say also give support to Attorney General Hawley. Because he's going to go and fight a battle. And, you know, our courts are not friendly to pro-life issues. And that's usually where we lose a lot of our good laws that are passed. Not because they're bad laws, but because we have activist judges that support abortion that are ruling in the favor of Planned Parenthood without looking at the true issue and care that women are getting or not getting in these so-called clinics.
Well, yeah, and let me ask you this, too. This is, of course, we're talking about a Missouri case and Missouri clinics and that sort of thing. But how might this impact in terms of a precedent? How might it impact the rest of the country?
Well, anytime any court makes a decision, and we do this when we write laws, we always look at any kind of court decision and what the court opens up for us to be able to, you know, go through and save lives and protect women. And the abortion industry does the same thing. So, you know, obviously we have a concern. Missouri was the first state to pass these two good laws that care about women and care about babies. So there are other states that are going to be affected by this court decision, as we have been by the U.S. Supreme Court decision. But it's not over yet. You know, obviously we all need to pray, you know, that we can, you know, block what this judge has blocked. That these laws will stay in effect and babies can be saved and women can be protected from the deceptions of Planned Parenthood.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to take a real chance here because we've got a caller on the line here. And, of course, my interface is not working, so I can't get him on. So we're just going to go ahead. Susan, you and I are going to wrap up the program together. We've got just about a minute here. So, like you said, it would be worthwhile to, if you're a Missouri resident or if you're outside the state and you feel strongly about this, contact Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley's office and express your support for fighting this decision. And then, Susan, as you said, just praying is so important to do. And we need to make sure that we do that first before you pick up the phone, drop to your knees. Susan, the last word here in the last 30 seconds.
Well, I just, you know, Missouri Right to Life works in legislative area and writing these laws to save babies and protect women. And we work through education, legislation, and we do our political work. But our foundation is prayer. And that's
great.
Where we have to begin.
Thank you. And thank you for the work you do. Susan Klein, Executive Director of Missouri Right to Life. Thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. We appreciate you taking the time to listen and learn. This is Evan Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins. Have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.